The Tarot of the Bohemians by Papoose. An adult brain audiobook production. Read by Graham Dunlop. Preface to the English translation. An assumption of some kind being of common convenience, that the line of least resistance may be pursued thereafter, I will open the present consideration by assuming that those who are quite unversed in the subject have referred to the pages which follow, and have thus become aware that the tarot, on its external side, is the probable progenitor of playing cards, that, like these, it has been used for divination and for all that is understood by fortune-telling, but that behind that it is held to have a higher interest and another quality of importance. On a simple understanding, it is of allegory. It is of symbolism on a higher plane. And in fine, it is of secret doctrine very curiously veiled. The justification of these views is a different question. I am concerned with the statement of fact that such views are held. And this being said, I can pass to my real business, which is in part critical and in part also explanatory, though not exactly on the elementary side. It should be understood that there are several methods of constructing the hieroglyphic emblems of the tarot into a definite language of symbolism. Setting aside the school of ordinary research which has naturally met with these pictures in elucidating the antiquities of playing cards, there is the school of vulgar divination working on the traditional lines of printed books or on uninstructed intuition, using, however, as a rule both these aids to interpretation, and having, as there is little need to add, no canon of criticism regarding them. Outside this, there are certain occult or mystic colleges which claim to possess a true key to the symbolism. And there is another, more withdrawn school, the existence of which has not so far transpired in the external world. It is affirmed to possess the final meanings, of which all the others are a shadow, and it differs to this extent from anything that has been put forward recently under the pretext of occult revelations. M. Gerard Ancus, most of whose works have appeared under the name of Papoose, is the head of the School of Martinism in Paris and is a member of the modern Kabbalistic Order of the Rose Cross. Neither of these colleges has any heritage in tradition, but both are indefatigable in research of one kind or another, and within the measure of their respective spheres, which in the ultimate are a single sphere, they deserve and should receive reasonable praise. Whatever human patience equipped with some leaven of learning can devise regarding the tarot will be found in the Tarot of the Bohemians, a second edition of which, in its English form, is being prefaced by these few words. So far as history is concerned, the thesis of Papoose depends from whatever is regarded as of authority among French occult writers. But as to this, there are a few points over which I must act as a moderator. In respect of philosophical construction, the author has his own lights, and the fact that he has done the best that could be expected in virtue of a general equipment only is to be inferred from the further fact, by way of antithesis, that there is no living person who seems to have done so well. I do not propose to exhaust and shall hardly have recourse to criticism on this side of the subject, but there are a few things which will be added. In the matter of divinatory methods, and such offices of vanity, Papoose, in so far as I am qualified to judge, has all the knowledge that can be needed, or in fact desired, by those who are interested in proceedings of this kind. It is probable that in his heart he appraises them at their proper value, and it may be observed that his seven lessons on the divining tarot occupy a small portion only of his not unambitious work. But at a later period he has thought fit to attempt a wider appeal in this particular direction, and it is really out of this fact that these prefatory remarks arise, foreseeing that he has just issued Le Tarot Divinatoire. It seems desirable, while reserving a proper spirit of detachment, to say something, if one word only, concerning it in producing a reprint of the Tarot of the Bohemians. I have thus secured an excuse to speak of matters more serious, and I now take them in their order. The chief point regarding the history of tarot cards, whether used as pretext for fortune-telling or as symbols for philosophical interpretation, is that such history does not in fact exist. There are tangible, symbolical reasons for believing that some part of them is exceedingly old in conception, though not in form, and perhaps, in the last resource, they can be held to rank as the more interesting and curious on this account. The earliest cards which are extant belong to the late 14th century. But to question whence they came or where they originated offers, in the absence of any certitude, only a field for speculation. And this has been industrious, as usual, opening the debate at Byzantium and closing it, to the satisfaction of several makers-in-chief, of reverie somewhere in the great refuge of China, where that cohort of which it might be said omnia exuunt in mysterium seems to pause always on its way through the unknown. This is my first act of moderation in respect of the apparent conviction with which the Tarot of the Bohemian speaks of the primeval hieroglyphs of the Book of Thoth. Omni ignotum pro antiquissimo, and this is how history is made in the French occult circles. I mention the point that I may do something to exonerate Papus, who has followed a very strong lead of antecedent writers among these who confess to his predispositions. First in the point of time is Court de Gobelins, who published between 1773 and 1782 the nine great quarto volumes of Le Monde Primitif. It is not so very long after all since he used to be termed a great archaeologist, but there has risen up in Paris, say yesterday or thereabouts, a new authority on l'art de tirer la carte, and he is of opinion that Court de Gobelins was a denizen elect of Bicêtre, who perished through his utter distraction in the matter of animal magnetism. I've been at the pains to consider, and I find that this putative authority is qualified to tell a few light stories concerning cartomancists. That he has thrown into his pot some dictionaries of occult science, and has so produced a compilation of divinatory arts. But I find further that he knows nothing of tarot symbolism, and for this reason, and for all others that I have cited, he has elected to call himself M. Antonio Magus, which title he shall hold in perpetuity without let or taxation. But his strictures demonstrate nothing, and as there is no reason why experiments in animal magnetism should not open the gates of eternity, even for an illustrious archaeologist, I will again act as a moderator. Ruling as such, there can, I suppose, be no question that Court de Gobelins was a most considerable savant for his period, or that he was especially instructed in things Egyptian a generation or so before Egyptology first came into being. On these warrants, he affirms the Egyptian origin of tarot cards and the mode of demonstration which he adopts, to render his conviction contagious, centers in their alleged allegorical confirmatory with the civil, religious, and philosophical doctrine of the old world of the Delta. But if we ask for some details of the conformity, we shall find that we must be content with what we have, that is to say, with the simple affirmation, ex sedi sapiente. The circumstances under which the savant attained this certitude are briefly that he saw the game of tarot played at the house of a friend, and he there and then declared, A, that it was one of the Egyptian books, and B, that it was the sole remaining vestige of the superb libraries and literature which once flourished in the valley of the Nile. And this is precisely what, it seems to me, falls short of plenary persuasiveness. I respect M. de Gobelins for having conceived Egyptology by an act of the mind so long before it could have been conceived in any body of research. I respect him also for having had, out of previous expectation, a vision concerning the tarot. But as he did not marry his vision to any facts on this earth, I think that he has only begotten a phantom son of the fancy. But to do him the better justice, let me add that he does offer one typical illustration in detail. The fifth major trump in the series called Greater Arcana is the High Priest, Pope, or Hierophant. But the second is the High Priestess, and it is obvious for Court de Gobelins that these are husband and wife. I know not why, unless it is that they have done what they could to get away from each other in the series. But the point is that the alleged fact shows that the Egyptian origin, seeing that the chiefs of the priesthood, sometimes, generally, always, again, I do not know, had a way of being married in Egypt. Now, from all this, it seems to follow for Dr. Papus, that the tarot is the Bible of Bibles, the Book of Thoth, and of primitive revelation. But so sharp an indication may appear to the careful reader a little more than true and less than kind, for Papus has many authorities besides the first French savant who spoke of the tarot. There are J. A. Valiant, Eliphas Levi, William Postel, Jerome Cardan, and L. C. and de Saint Martin. But whatever has been said by the first of these writers regarding the Egyptian origin of the cards depends not from his knowledge of antiquities, to which he made no claim, but from his borrowed theory that the gypsies, whom he knew at first hand, came from Indo-Tartary through the valley of the Nile, and it stands or falls therewith. Now, I believe that in later knowledge it has sometime since fallen, like Babylon. In respect to Eliphas Levi, it is a matter of common familiarity that his opinion on any question of fact was sometimes more than worthless, and occasionally a little bit less than intellectually honest. He affirms, A, that the tarot is possibly anterior to the Book of Enoch, not any apocryphal work which passes under that name, but something ecstatic and undemonstrable, something which is of mystic rumor wild, so wild indeed that the name proves in the end to be a synonym for the tarot itself, suggesting thus an inscrutable verbal impasse. He affirms further, B, that it is the symbolical summary of primitive tradition, C, that it is the keystone of occult science, and D, that it is the Book of Hermes. Views of this kind, and thus arbitrarily expressed, seem obvious of the order of revelation and are to be taken or left according to the disposition of the recipient. In the case of Eliphas Levi, they have obtained considerable vogue in the circle to which he appeals because of the authority ascribed to him. It remains only to deal with the other witnesses for the defense, and this can also be done shortly. Dr. Papus dreams stertorously when he says that Raymond Lully, who was termed in his day the illuminated doctor of Mallorca, based his Ars Magna on the tarot keys, and I suggest that he has omitted to read the colossal sheaf of treatises, which are included under that title. He may be forgiven in advance for the fact, but all the same he is not entitled to speak. The genuine Raymond Lully knew as much of the Book of Thoth as he did of those operations in alchemy which are also ascribed to him. The statement that Jerome Cardan developed his work, the Subtilitate, from the same source depends from Eliphas Levi, and has the advantage of his imagination to support it. When Cardan was exocogitating the plan of his curious product of his genius, he dreamed that it should be in 21 parts, which is good enough for French occultists to connect it with the Trumps major, Hormis Le Fou, as a kind of ineffable in zero. It treats of the earth and mountains, of celestial and atmospheric phenomena, of metallic substances, of botany, of animal creation, of man, angels, and demons. The report that Postel, who wrote, among other tracts, A Key of Things Kept Secret from the Foundation of the World, discovered in the tarot the elements of all the mysteries, derives also from Levi, who forgot that the allegorical key prefixed to the work in question was not the device of Postel, but, as I have shown elsewhere, a reverie by way of explanation contrived by one of his editors. Finally, the statement that Saint Martin found his doctrine of the correspondences between God, man, and the universe in the 22 trump cards is the masterpiece of Levi's intuition and has the great justification that the mystic tableau naturel, like the apocalypse itself, happens to have 22 sections or chapters. Taking all the circumstances into consideration and the fact that the names here cited are those of the masters of Papus, de Gabelin, Levi, Valiant, I think that it is much to his credit that he has not increased the confusion by adding historical considerations of his own, but has simply reproduced his precursors. One important point remains to be added, that the presence of certain crude semi-Egyptian figures, in some extent tarot cards, for example, the Sphinx, signifies imported symbolism unknown to Court de Gabelin, who would only have rejoiced at the opportunity. I conclude generally that the cards are prior to the end of the 14th century, and that we know nothing further concerning them. I regard them personally as much older because of their symbolism, and the fact that they were widely diffused in southern France at the end of the 18th century may, even at that later time, indicate the line of their transmission to us. Many things which came from far away entered Western Europe by the port of Marseille. Now, it should be clear even to the casual reader that in the tarot of the Bohemians, nothing depends from the historical side, which is a matter of simple assumption, on the warrants that have come into the author's hands, apart from anything that can be called research on his own part. It carries no consequence in respect of his later considerations. I am anxious to establish this fact, even at the risk of some verbal repetition, so that no prejudice may be taken over to the philosophical interpretation which is the real concern of Papus. The Egyptian derivation of tarot symbols is, in respect thereof, in much the same position as their use in cartomancy. It is something entirely extrinsic. And now regarding his construction of the whole symbolic language, this is largely the result of first-hand thinking, though again he has used materials which he has inherited from his school. As such, it demands herein that which it has received in France, namely, our serious consideration, because it is sincere after its own kind, has been worked out with modesty in respect of the final issues, while it exhibits there and here some qualities of insight. It may be convenient to summarize shortly the ruling plan of the procedure. This begins and ends in a particular form of Kabbalism married to a mysticism of numbers which is not exactly Kabbalistic, but has analogies or reflections of this kind, and is otherwise of some antiquity. Once more, it is not the invention of Papus. The one and the other are centralized in a theosophic doctrine concerning the divine name, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, Jehovah. From the mystery of this name there depends the whole theosophy of Jewry, as it is developed in the Sefer HaZohar, or Book of Splendor, and the commentaries thereon. Papus allocates the four suits which comprise the lesser arcana to the tarot to the four letters of this name, and the 22 trumps which comprise the major arcana. He also allocates thereto and to the letters of the Hebrew alphabet. We are concerned, however, more especially with the divine name. The first letter, or Yod, represents, as he tells us, the principle or origin of all things, and hence eternal force. It is also, as we may learn from more authoritative sources, the symbol of the divine royalty. It is the occultation of wisdom and embodies its concealed things. It is represented as corresponding in the tarot to the suit of wands or scepters and to the kings in the court cards. The second letter is He, which signifies substance in contradistinction to essence. It is said by the Kabbalists that the creation took place therewith. It is the principle of production, and is thus termed the mother. It corresponds in the tarot to the suit of cups and to the queens in the court cards. The third letter is Vav, which signifies the affinity that subsists between the first two letters, and it competes with these the root idea of the Trinity. In pure Kabbalism, it is the bond of love, the mystery of union and of the intercommunication and superincession of the celestial virtues. It is also the tree of life. It corresponds in the tarot to the suit of swords and to the knights in the court cards. The fourth letter is He, and it represents the transition from the metaphysical to the physical worlds, from the noumenal to the phenomenal. Christian Kabbalism says that it is divinity united hypostatically to a terrestrial body, or more literally, it is the Word made flesh. And although there is no question that nearly everything which has been put forward in this interest must be withdrawn, the doctrine of Messiahs in Jewry calls for reconsideration in the light of Christian Trinitarian doctrine. The second He corresponds in the tarot to the suit of pentacles, and to the esquires, pages or knaves in the court cards. Kindred analogies are established in respect of 10 numbered cards, and Monsieur Charles Bartlett, for whose authority Dr. Papus seems to assume responsibility, has contrived to connect them after another fashion with the letters of the divine name. Through the court cards of their respective suits, by the help of an attribution which is specified in an essay on the initiative tarot. So long as Papus has the obvious similitude of four suits to connect with four letters, his task has an air of simplicity. Though its involved extensions may persuade few of his readers who are not otherwise persuaded previously, but while he recognizes that it is still more important to establish the same analogies in respect of the major arcana, he passes of necessity among them into a region of greater uncertainty. However, as the results of his efforts, he has exocogitated a septenary application and finds that in each septenary, it is possible to establish a dual correspondence with the divine name by making the number 4, which completes the first tetrad, act as the first number which enters into the second tetrad. Thus, 1, 2, 3, 4 equals Yod, He, Vau, He. 4, 5, 6, 7 equals Yod, He, Vau, He. To complete his analogy, he adopts another method, explaining that in any septenary of trumps major, the cards 1 and 4 correspond to Yod, 2 and 5 to He, 3 and 6 to Vau, and the 7th card to the second He. The scheme is arbitrary enough, as it is also contradictory enough. In the second septenary, he makes a second act of reversion, and thus the correspondences to the 4 letters are 7 and 10, Yod, 8 and 11, He, 9 and 12, Vau, 13, He, final. In the third septenary, cards 13 and 16, Yod, 14 and 17, He, 15 and 18, Vau, and he is then left with the trumps major 19, 20, and 21, and with the 0, or Fool. With these, he does what he can, making a brave struggle, but the result is not convincing. I will now give a casual indication of his whole difficulty. He does not know what to do with the card which is numbered 0 in the major trump series, and his septenary distribution leaves him therefore in the lurch, while his allocation to the Hebrew letters outside those of the divine name is also open to question. The attempt to connect the symbols of the tarot with the system of Kabbalistic theosophy will seem in itself arbitrary, but it can, under certain circumstances, produce very curious results. It did not, as I have said, originate with Papus, who follows the attribution given by Eliphas Levi. Some vestiges of another scheme have appeared in recent times, but they are also an imperfect reading. The true reading has long been held in reserve, and this so strictly that many who believe that they possess it have only been passed through one of the veils which conceal it. If ever the whole system contained in the tarot came to be worked out, which will scarcely be in our time, it might even prove that its attribution to the Hebrew alphabet obtains only in the lesser degrees. To those, however, it is important. It is time otherwise to say that the connection with Kabbalism may be in some respects like the Egyptian connection. As the latter is arbitrary and apart from evidence in history, so the other is also fictitious and apart from final warrant in the highest world of symbolism. The work of Papus will appeal only to serious students, and it will be worth their while to take up his elements and seek to construct them independently. Let them remember that there are 4 worlds in Kabbalism, as there are 4 suits in the tarot. One indication more, the tarot in its proper understanding contains Catholic symbolism, and when Papus says that it expresses the combinations of Yeve, J-E-V-E, this means that it typifies the elements and mysteries of the divine immanence. These are the true letters of the true word, and as things without correspond to things within, that which is below to that which is above, so the characters which represent the human word are in certain respects their analogy. In his later work, Le Tarot Divinatoire, published at Paris in the course of the last year, Papus dwells on the necessity of taking the major and minor arcana in connection one with the other, as distinguished from several French methods which lay stress on the major only. He affirms that the minor are as important for the study of the subject as are the houses of the heavens for that of astrology. In respect of cartomancy, at least, there is no question that he is right, and this is his concern in the work. In respect of the higher constructions, he promises a new edition of his previous book, about which I do not think that we need feel especially disturbed, since he gives ample evidence that he adheres to the same system. As regards divinatory methods, he draws his materials from Moreau, from the cartomancist Atea, and from de Doucet, from Atea, more than all. For those who are concerned with such matters, the result seems therefore exhaustive, and it includes the modifications of the root meanings by the various combinations of the cards, in their apposition to one another as the result of dealing. The tarot cards have, however, just been issued in England by the publishers of the present work, together with their advanced interpretation on mystic lines and a corrected mode of divination, which, so far as I am aware, has not been printed previously. It will form an essential supplement to the tarot of the Bohemians and will dispense with all need of reference to Le Tarot Divinatoire. The opportunity of the present edition has been taken to revise the translation, which had certain imperfections as it stood, owing to unfamiliarity with the terms of occult literature. A. E. Waite. Preface. The tarot pack of cards transmitted by the gypsies from generation to generation is the primitive book of ancient initiation. This has been clearly demonstrated by Guillaume Postel, Court de Gobelin, Atiella, Eliphas Levi, and J.A. Valiant. The key to its construction and application has not yet been revealed, so far as I know. I therefore wish to fill up this deficiency by supplying initiates, i.e., those who are acquainted with the elements of occult science, with an accurate guide, which would assist them in the pursuit of their studies. The uninitiated reader will find in it the explanation of the lofty philosophy and science of ancient Egypt, whilst ladies are enabled to practice the use of the divining tarot by methods which we have rendered easy in Chapter 20. The book has been so arranged that each part forms a complete whole, which can, if necessary, be studied separately. I have used every effort to be as clear as possible. The public that has warmly welcomed my other books will, I hope, forgive the imperfections inherent to a work of this kind. Papus. Chapter 1. Introduction to the Study of the Tarot. Approaching End of Materialism, Synthesis, the Occult Science, the Secret Societies, the Cultists, the People, Organ of the Transmission of Esotericism, the Gypsies, the Sacred Word of Freemasonry, Our Work. Therefore, you must open the book and carefully weigh the statements made in it. Then you will know that the drug within is of very different value from the promise of the box. That is to say, that the subjects treated in it are not so frivolous as the title may imply. Rabelais. We are on the eve of a complete transformation of our scientific methods. Materialism has given us all that we can expect from it, and inquirers, disappointed as a rule, hope for great things from the future, whilst they are unwilling to spend more time in pursuing the path adopted in modern times. Analysis has been carried in every branch of knowledge as far as possible, and has only deepened the moats which divide the sciences. Synthesis becomes necessary. But how can we realize it? If we would condescend to waive for one moment our belief in the indefinite progress and fatal superiority of later generations over the ancients, we should at once perceive that the colossal civilizations of antiquity possessed science, universities, and schools. India and Egypt are still strewn with valuable remains, which reveal to archaeologists the existence of this ancient science. We are now in a position to affirm that the dominant character of this teaching was synthesis, which condenses in a few very simple laws the whole of the acquired knowledge. But the use of synthesis had been almost entirely lost through several causes which it is important to enumerate. Amongst the ancients, knowledge was only transmitted to men whose worth had been proved by a series of tests. This transmittal took place in the temples, under the name of mysteries, and the adept assumed the title of priest or initiate. This science was therefore secret or occult, and thus originated the name of occult science, given by our contemporaries to the ancient synthesis. Another reason for the limited diffusion of the higher branches of knowledge was the length and difficulty of the journeys involved before the most important centers of initiation could be reached. However, when the initiates found that a time was approaching when these doctrines might be lost to humanity, they made strenuous efforts to save the law of synthesis from oblivion. Three great methods were used for this purpose. 1. Secret societies, a direct continuation of the mysteries. 2, the cultus, a symbolic translation of the higher doctrines for the use of the people. And 3, lastly, the people itself became the unconscious depository of the doctrine. Let us now see what use each of these groups made of the treasure confided to it. The secret societies. The School of Alexandria was the principal source from which the secret societies of the West arose. The majority of the initiates had taken refuge in the East, and quite recently, in 1884, the West discovered the existence in India, and above all in Tibet, of an occult fraternity which possessed practically the ancient synthesis in its integrity. The Theosophite Society was founded with the object of uniting Western initiation with Oriental initiation. But we are less interested in the existence of this doctrine in the East than in the history of the development of the initiative societies in the West. The Gnostic sects, the Arabs, alchemists, Templars, Rosicrucians, and lastly the Freemasons, from the Western chain in the transmission of occult science. A rapid glance over the doctrines of these associations is sufficient to prove that the present form of Freemasonry has almost entirely lost the meanings of the traditional symbols, which constitute the trust which it ought to have transmitted through the ages. The elaborate ceremonials of the ritual appear ridiculous to the vulgar common sense of a lawyer or grocer, the actual modern representatives of the profound doctrines of antiquity. We must, however, make some exceptions in favor of great thinkers like Ragone and a few others. In short, Freemasonry has lost the doctrine confided to it and cannot by itself provide us with the synthetic law for which we are seeking. The cultus. The secret societies were to transmit in their symbolism the scientific side of primitive initiation. The religious sects were to develop the philosophical and metaphysical aspects of the doctrine. Every priest of an ancient creed was one of the initiates. That is to say, he knew perfectly well that only one religion existed, and that the cultists merely served to translate this religion to the different nations according to their particular temperaments. This fact led to one important result, namely that a priest, no matter which of the gods he served, was received with honor in the temples of all the other gods, and was allowed to offer sacrifice to them. Yet this circumstance must not be supposed to imply any idea of polytheism. The Jewish high priest in Jerusalem received one of the initiates, Alexander the Great, into the temple, and led him into the Holy of Holies to offer sacrifice. Our religious disputes for the supremacy of one creed over another would have caused much amusement to one of the ancient initiate priests. They were unable to suppose that intelligent men could ignore the unity of all creeds in one fundamental religion. Sectarianism, chiefly sustained by two creeds equally blinded by their errors, the Christian and the Muslim, was the cause of the total loss of the secret doctrine which gave the key to synthetic unity. Still greater labor is required to rediscover synthesis in our Western religions than to find it in Freemasonry. The Jews alone possessed no longer the spirit but the letter of their oral or Kabbalistic traditions. The Bible, written in Hebrew, is marvelous from this point of view, for it contains all the occult traditions, although its true sense has never yet been revealed. Fabre d'Olivet commenced this prodigious work, but the ignorant descendants of the Inquisition at Rome have placed these studies on the list of those prohibited. Posterity will judge them. Yet every cultus has its tradition, its book, its Bible, which teach those who know how to read them the unity of all creeds, in spite of the difference existing in the ritual of various countries. The Sefer Bereshit of Moses is the Jewish Bible. The Apocalypse and the Esoteric Gospels form the Christian Bible. The Legend of Hiram is the Bible of Freemasonry. The Odyssey, the Bible of the so-called polytheism of Greece. The Aeneid, that of Rome. And lastly, the Hindu Vedas and the Muslim Quran are well known to all students of ancient theology. To anyone possessing the key, all these Bibles reveal the same doctrine. But this key, which can open esotericism, is lost by the sectarians of our Western creeds. It is therefore useless to seek for it any longer amongst them. The people. The sages were under no illusions respecting the possible future of the tradition, which they confided to the intelligence and virtue of future generations. Moses had chosen a people to hand down through succeeding ages the book which contained all the science of Egypt. But before Moses, the Hindu initiates had selected a nation to hand down to the generations of the future the primitive doctrines of the great civilizations of the Atlantides. The people have never disappointed the expectations of those who trusted it. Understanding none of the truths which it possessed, it carefully abstained from altering them in any way and treated the least attack made upon them as sacrilege. Thus the Jews have transmitted intact to us the letters which form the Sefer of Moses. But Moses had not solved the problem so authoritatively as the Tibetans. It was a great thing to give the people a book which it could adore respectfully and always guard intact, but to give it a book which would enable it to live was yet better. The people entrusted with the transmission of occult doctrines from the earliest ages was the Bohemian or Gypsy race. The Gypsies. The Gypsies possess a Bible which has proved their means of gaining a livelihood, for it enables them to tell fortunes. At the same time, it has been a perpetual source of amusement, for it enables them to gamble. Yes, the game of cards called the tarot, which the Gypsies possess, is the Bible of Bibles. It is the book of Thoth, Hermes, Trismegistus, the book of Adam, the book of the primitive revelation of ancient civilizations. Thus, whilst the Freemason, an intelligent and virtuous man, has lost the tradition, whilst the priest, also intelligent and virtuous, has lost his esotericism, the Gypsy, although both ignorant and vicious, has given us the key which enables us to explain all the symbolism of the ages. We must admire the wisdom of the initiates, who utilized vice and made it produce more beneficial results than virtue. The Gypsy Pack of Cards is a wonderful book according to the Court de Gobelin and Valiant. This pack, under the name of Tarot, Thora, Rota, has formed the basis of the synthetic teachings of all the ancient nations successively. In it, where a man of the people only sees a means of amusement, the thinker will find the key to an obscure tradition. Raymond Lull has passed his Ars Magna upon the tarot. Jerome Cardan has written a treatise upon subtlety from the keys of the tarot. Guillaume Postel has found in it the key to the ancient mysteries, whilst Louis-Claude de Saint-Martin, the only philosopher, finds written in it the mysterious links which unite God, the universe, and man. Through the tarot, we are now able to discover and develop the synthetic law concealed in all these symbolisms. The hour is approaching when the missing word will be refound. Masters, Rosicrucian, and Kadosh, you who form the sacred triangle of Masonic initiation, do you remember? Remember, Master, that illustrious man killed through the most cowardly of conspiracies. Remember Hiram, whose resurrection promised by the branch of Acacia, thou art looking for in faith. Remember Rosicrucian, the mysterious word which thou hast sought for so long, for which the meaning still escapes thee. Remember Kadosh, the magnificent symbol which radiated from the center of the luminous triangle when the real meaning of the letter G was revealed to thee. Hiram, Inri, Yod-Hi, Vau-Hi indicate the same mystery under different aspects. He who understands one of these words possesses the key which opens the tomb of Hiram, the symbol of the synthetic science of the ancients. He can open the tomb and fearlessly grasp the heart of the revered master, the symbol of esoteric teaching. The whole tarot is based upon this word, Rota, R-O-T-A, arranged as a wheel. Inri, I-N-R-I, is the word which indicates the unity of your origin, Freemasons and Catholics. Igni Natura, Renovatur Integra. Jesus, Nazareus, Rex Judeorum are the opposite poles, scientific and religious, physical and metaphysical, of the same doctrine. Yod-Hi Vau-Hi is the word which indicates to you both, Freemasons and Kabbalists, the unity of your origin. Tarot, Thora, Rota are the words which point out to you all, Easterns and Westerns, the unity of your requirements and of your aspirations in the eternal Adam Eve, the source of all our knowledge and of all our creeds. All honor, therefore, to the gypsy nomad, to whom we are indebted for the preservation of this marvelous instrument, the synthetic summary of the whole teaching of antiquity. Our work. We will commence by a preliminary study of the elements of the Kabbalah and of numbers. Supplied with these data, we will explain the construction of the tarot in all its details, studying separately each of the pieces which compose our machine, then studying the action of these pieces upon each other. Upon this point, we shall be as explicit as possible. We will then touch upon some applications of the machine, but upon a few only, leaving to the genuine inquirer the work of discovering others. We must confine our personal work to giving a key, based upon a synthetic formula. We can only supply the implement of labor in order that those who wish for knowledge may use it as they like, and we feel assured that they will understand the utility of our efforts and of their own. Lastly, we will do our best to explain the elements of divination by the tarot as practiced by the gypsies. But those who think that occult science should not be revealed must not be too angry with us. Experience has taught us that everything may be fearlessly said, that only those who should understand can understand. The others will accuse our work of being obscure and incomprehensible. We have warned them by placing at the head of our work, for the exclusive use of initiates. It is one characteristic of the study of true occult science that it may be freely explained to all men. Like the parables, so dear to the ancients, it appears to many only the expression of the flight of a bold imagination. We need, therefore, never be afraid of speaking too openly. The word will only reach those who should be touched by it. To you all, philosophers of unity, enemies of scientific, social, and religious sectarianism, I now address myself. To you, I dedicate this result of several years' study. May I thus aid in the erection of the temple which you are about to raise to the honor of the unknown God, from whom all the others emanate throughout eternity. Part 1. General Key to the Tarot, Giving the Absolute Key to Occult Science. Notes about the footnotes. I will read in full the footnotes that are not just a plain reference. Chapter 2. The Sacred Word, Yod-Heh Vav-Heh. The Kabbalah and the Sacred Word, the Yod, the He, the Vav, the second He, synthesis of the sacred word. According to the ancient oral tradition of the Hebrews or Kabbalah, a sacred word exists which gives to the mortal who can discover the correct way of pronouncing it the key to all the sciences, divine and human. Footnote 1. It appears, according to the most famous rabbis, that Moses himself, foreseeing the fate which awaited his book, and the false interpretations which would be given to it in the course of time, resorted to an oral law, which he delivered verbally to reliable men, whose fidelity he had tested and whom he charged to transmit it to others in the secret of the sanctuary, who in their turn, transmitting it from age to age, secured its preservation, even for the most distant posterity. This oral law, which modern Jews still flatter themselves that they possess, is called the Kabbalah. From a Hebrew word which signifies that which is received, that which comes from elsewhere, that which passes from hand to hand. Fabra d'olive. The restored Hebrew language. End of note. This word, which the Israelites never uttered, and which the high priest pronounced once a year, amidst the shouts of the laity, is found at the head of every initiative ritual. It radiates from the center of the flaming triangle at the 33rd degree of the Freemasonry of Scotland. It is displayed above the gateways of our old cathedrals. It is formed of four Hebrew letters and reads thus, Yod-Heh Vav-Heh. It is used in the Sefer Bereshit, or Genesis of Moses, To designate the divinity, and its grammatical construction recalls, even by its formation, the attributes which men have always delighted to ascribe to God. Footnote. This name presents first the sign which indicates life, repeated twice, and thus forming the essentially living root, e. This root is never used as a noun, and is the only one which enjoys the prerogative. It is from its formation not only a verb, but a unique verb, from which all the others are merely derivations. In short, the verb, eve, eve, to be, being, here, as we can see, and as I have carefully explained in my grammar, the sign of intelligible light, vau, is placed in the midst of the root of life. Moses, when using this unique verb to form the proper name of the being of beings, added to it the sign of potential manifestation and of eternity. I. He thus obtained I-E-V-E, in which the faculative being is placed between a past tense without origin and a future without limit. This admirable word thus exactly signifies the being who is, who was, and who will be. Fabula d'Olive, the restored Hebrew language. Now we shall see that the powers attributed to this word are real up to a certain point, for with its aid, the symbolical gate of the arch, which contains the explanation of the whole doctrine of ancient science, is easily opened. It is therefore necessary to enter into some detail respecting it. The word is formed of four letters, yod, he, vau, he. This last letter, he, is repeated twice. A number is attributed to each letter of the Hebrew alphabet. We must look at those which relate to the letters we are now considering. Yod equals 10, he equals 5, vau equals 6. The total numerical value of the word, yod he vau he, is therefore 10 plus 5 plus 6 plus 5 equals 26. Let us now study each letter separately. The yod. The yod, shaped like a comma or a dot, represents the principle or origin of all things. The other letters of the Hebrew alphabet are all produced by different combinations of the letter yod. The synthetic study of nature had led the ancients to conclude that one law only existed and ruled all natural productions. This law, the basis of analogy, placed the unity principle at the origin of all things and regarded them as the reflections at various degrees of this unity principle. Thus the yod, which alone forms all the other letters, and therefore all the words and all the phrases of the alphabet, was justly used as the image and representation of this unity principle, of which the profane had no knowledge. Thus the law which presided over the creation of the Hebrew language is the same law that presided over the creation of the universe, and to know the one is to know the other, unreservedly. The Sefer Yetzirah, one of the most ancient books of the Kabbalah, proves this fact. Before proceeding any further, let us illustrate the definition which we have just given of the yod by an example. The first letter of the Hebrew alphabet, the Aleph, is composed of four yods placed opposite to each other. The other letters are all formed on the same basis. The numerical value of the yod leads to other considerations. The unity principle, according to the doctrine of the Kabbalists, is also the unity end of beings and of things, so that eternity, from this point of view, is only an eternal present. The ancients used a dot in the center of a circle as the symbol of this idea, the representation of the unity principle, the dot in the center of eternity, the circle, a line without beginning or end. According to these demonstrations, the unity is regarded as the whole, of which all created beings are only the constituent parts, just as the unity man is formed of an agglomeration of molecules which compose his being. The Kabbalah, therefore, places at the origin of all things the absolute assertion of the being by itself of the ego unity, which is represented by the yod symbolically and by the number 10. This number 10, representing the all-principle one with the zero-nothing, zero, well supplies the requisite conditions. The he, but the ego cannot be realized except through its opposition to the non-ego. The assertion of the ego is scarcely established when we must instantly realize a reaction of the ego, absolute, upon itself, from which the conception of its existence will be drawn by a kind of division of the unity. This is the origin of duality, of opposition, of the binary, the image of femininity, even as the unity is the image of the masculine. 10 divided by itself in opposition to itself, then equals 10, divided by 2 equals 5. 5, the exact number of the letter He, the second letter of the great sacred name. The He therefore represents the passive in relation to the Yod, which symbolizes the active, the non-ego in relation to the ego, the woman relatively to the man, the substance relatively to the essence, life in its relation to the soul, etc., etc. The vow. But the opposition of the ego and the non-ego immediately gives rise to another factor. This is the affinity existing between this ego and this non-ego. Now the vow, the sixth letter of the Hebrew alphabet produced by 10, Yod, plus 5, He, equals 15, equals 6, or 1 plus 5, signifies link or analogy. It is the link which, uniting antagonisms in the whole of nature, constitutes the third word of this mysterious trinity, ego, non-ego, affinity of the ego with the non-ego. The second He. Nothing can exist beyond this trinity, considered as a law. The trinity is the synthetic and absolute formula to which all the sciences converge. And this formula, forgotten with regard to its scientific value, has been transmitted to us integrally by all the religious of the world, the unconscious depositaries of the science wisdom of primitive civilizations. Footnote, translated here from Latin to English, see Louis Lucas, Le Roman Alchemique. Beyond these three numbers, there is no other magnitude, for three is everything, and everywhere threefold, as the Pythagoreans say, all things and everything are determined by three. Aristotle, quoted by Ostrowski, page 24 of his Mathis. Thus, the great sacred name is formed of three letters only. The fourth term of the name is formed by the repetition of the second letter, the He. This repetition indicates the passage of the Trinitarian law into a new application. That is, to speak correctly, a transition from the metaphysical to the physical world, or generally, of any world whatever to the world that immediately follows it. Footnote. Ostrowski has seen this clearly. The passage of 3 and 4 corresponds to that of the Trimurti in Maya. And as the latter opens the second ternary of the pre-Genesetic decade, so the figure 4 opens that of the second ternary of our Genesetic decimal. Mathis, page 25. The knowledge of the property of the second He is the key to the whole divine name, in every application of which it is susceptible. We shall presently see the proof of this statement. Summary upon the word Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. Now that we have separately studied each of the letters that compose the sacred name, we will apply the law of synthesis to them and sum up the results obtained. The word Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh is formed of four letters signifying the Yod, the active principal preeminent, the ego equals 10, the He, the passive principal preeminent, the non-ego equals 5, the Vav, the median letter, the link which unites the active to the passive, the affinity between the ego and the non-ego equals 6. These three letters express the Trinitarian law of the absolute. The second He marks the passage from one world to another, the transition. This second He represents the complete being, comprising in one absolute unity the three letters which compose it, ego, non-ego, affinity. It indicates the passage from the noumenal to the phenomenal or reciprocal. It serves as means of ascension from one scale to another. Representation of the sacred word. The word Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh can be represented in various ways, which are all useful. The circle can be drawn in this way. Yod at the top, first He to the right, Vav to the bottom, first He to the left. But since the second he, the sign of transition becomes the active entity in the following scale, i.e., since this he only represents a yod in germ, the sacred word can be represented with the second he under the first yod, thus yod, first he, vow, second he. Footnote: the second he, upon which we are intentionally dwelling at some length, may be compared to a grain of wheat relatively to the ear. The ear, the Trinity manifest or yod he vow, exerts all its activity in the production of the grain of wheat, or second he. But this grain of wheat is only the transition between the ear which gave it birth and the ear to which it will itself give birth in the following generation. It is the transition between one generation and another which it contains in germ. This is why the second he is a yod in germ. Lastly, a third method of representing the word consists in enveloping the Trinity, yod he vow, with the tonalizating letter, or second he, thus: a circle with second he at the top, second he at the right, second he at the bottom, second he at the left, and yod he vow in a tiny triangle in the middle. Now we will leave these data, to which we must return later on, and speak of the occult or Pythagorean conception of numbers. Thank you for listening to this sample. To continue listening to this book and for access to all of our other full audiobooks, please subscribe for $7.77 per month. Go to adultbrain.ca or follow the link in the show notes. This will be a completely separate podcast with a new RSS feed and will have all the titles from this feed as well. Thank you for your help and support in bringing rare and forgotten books to audio for the world.